I'm your host, John Larson, and I'm here today joined by the lovely and effervescent. Sitting on my right now, you switch sides.
I know.
The effervescent Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
Hello, John. Hello, everybody.
We do actually have, is this the largest studio audience we've ever had?
This is the largest.
This studio is a little bit bigger than the old one because we don't have the bookshelves in here yet.
That was an odd. Well, you're saying that the rooms are the same size.
I think it's close to the size of the other room, don't you think? The other previous Studio 1A?
The other one's probably a little bigger.
This one's more basement-y. Okay, so from the first time we started the podcast, there's a principle in technical writing and academic writing these days, and I don't know what it's called, if anybody can tell me. The principle is that the writer shouldn't separate themselves as much from what they're writing. So if you read academic writing from 30 years ago, it's all in passive voice. And most of it still is. If you go pick up an academic journal, it's still written in passive voice, meaning the author writes themselves out of the narrative. But increasingly, that's not happening. And in the podcast world, some of the biggest and best podcasts some of the biggest and best podcasts, like the Adam Carolla Show or the Dan Savage podcast, have specifically woven themselves into the narrative. They don't separate what it is they're recording from what it is they're doing. The dilemma is it sounds a little narcissistic when you do that, but the benefit is it tamps down the idea of bias, because the bias is ever present. It's not hidden. You know where the author is coming from. Early on, I don't know when the decision was made, but we took that approach with Mormon Expression, and we tried to be critical in the traditional academic sense of the word critical, but we wanted to, you know, really address the issues, and we wanted to be clear about where we stood and where we hit on the spectrum.
Right. We didn't want to pretend that we were non-biased.
Right. Now, early in the days, I've been accused of saying in the early days I was pretending, but I would give deference, and we still do. We just don't do it as often. If we brought an apologist on, I'm more interested in what the apologist has to say than sort of sticking it to him. And I'm not really trying to trap anybody. I want to hear what their opinion is. So that was always our approach. And one of the things we did very early on is we would record a podcast every so often, usually about once a quarter or once every half year, where we would reflect on the podcast itself. And we would sort of try to pull back the curtain and show you what we were thinking and what we were approaching. The benefit of that was, I think, it gave the podcast more of a, it felt more like somebody was talking to you in your living room. It felt more personal. It felt more connected. And that's what we wanted. There is a certain amount of persona that's played just because you have the mics on. And you have to be a little bit more bellicose than you would be normally. But generally, it's us, right?
Mm-hmm.
What would you say is the biggest difference between us on the podcast and us in real life? I'm better looking on the podcast.
I don't think there is much of a difference.
So the way we interact on the podcast is very similar to the way we interact, you and I, in real life.
Generally.
Yes. So because we quickly became sort of the center of the podcast, because that's where we were, our individuality and our relationship became woven into the podcast, for good or for bad. It did put pressure on us in some ways, but I think oftentimes it allowed us to model behavior. I don't know.
I think sometimes that was the idea, to kind of, well, I think that's the really big idea behind this podcast that we're doing tonight, is to try to, maybe show how people can get through marital issues and even divorce and still treat each other with respect and even be friends. Even.
Yeah, so you skipped to the end of the book. There's a great big build-up there, didn't you see?
I was getting tired of the build-up.
Yeah, 2012 was a challenging year for us in a lot of different ways.
Way more than challenging.
There were a lot of things happening and a lot of things going on. And the thing about life is it's best understood when you're looking back. And I've given the analogy before. I don't remember what culture it is. I remember learning about it in an anthropology class where we have the metaphor of life, of you walking forward down a path, but this other indigenous culture. Isn't that kind of racist just to say the word indigenous? But has the idea that you're walking backwards because you can't really see what's in front of you. You can only see the path that's behind you. You can see where you've come. You can see what led you to the point you are. But what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day is completely blind. And I say that because as you're going through sometimes the roughest patches in your life, which we all will face, no one gets out alive, you oftentimes can't contextualize them or can't understand them when they're happening. And
you just know that it sucks.
Right. So you'll all probably know if you listen to the podcast regularly, we sort of put it on hiatus. Now, I've been yelled at saying, you said you wouldn't do it anymore, and then you came back and did it. But as I recall, we said we would do it less frequently. As a matter of fact, when we sort of retired, our plan was to do it once a month. But we ended up doing it a little less often because of what we're going to talk about here, because we were facing down our separation, our divorce.
Yeah, in crisis mode.
Mm-hmm. And so because we are John and Zilpha of Mormon Expression, and because people have listened to us and modeled what they think an idealized relationship should be, it was hard balancing that very personal thing of going through, especially the separation, when things are kind of at their worst, but you still don't know for sure where things are going to go, with realizing that there's a lot of eyes on you and there's a lot of people who are looking to you for information. So.
And a lot of rumors.
And a lot of rumors. And I actually don't blame the rumors. You know, I point out when I talk to people about gossip, We look at gossip as a negative thing. It's implied in the word, but I think really gossip is only negative when you're using it to hurt somebody. The reality is that we're social animals and we exchange information about one another are the currency of our lives and currency of love and friendship and all that kind of stuff. And oftentimes, though we all like the most salacious details, it comes ultimately, in my opinion, from a point of love that we're concerned about our friends. We do like to hear shit about them, but we are concerned about them.
Yeah, maybe more for entertainment. And out of interest sometimes, but.
So, in the fall in September of 2012 is when we, first decided to separate. And I actually, for good or for bad, made a public statement because there were already rumors going around and that sort of thing. We did an in-house separation. We had a large home and we sort of moved to the other side of the home or I did. And then we decided to give it another try. After about a week or two. we called it DOA, at the end of, what? You just gave me a look.
Oh, I thought you burped.
Oh, I did.
Okay.
It was the first
week of December.
I remember last week of November, but it was right after Thanksgiving. And, that's when we, I say permanently separated, and we've been separated since then. We're recording this on May 26th, and I moved out at the beginning of May. So we currently live in separate homes.
Right. So we were separated in the house for quite a long time, in separate bedrooms.
Quite a long time. I think I counted it as about 8 months or so that we lived together in a separated state. This podcast is not necessarily about the ways to a separation. There are advantages to doing that and there are disadvantages. But it worked for us.
Sort of. I mean, the advantage was, there were several advantages. First of all, we made sure that we definitely did want to separate before we actually you know, pulled the trigger as far as financial consequences and things like that go. And the children, like when John first moved bedrooms, he asked our oldest daughter, or our daughter, how she felt about it. And she said, oh, that's fine. I have my own bedroom. And she said, but if one of you moved out, then that would be really hard to deal with. So it kind of gave them some transition time to kind of get acclimated to the idea that we were going to be separating.
And the first conversations we had with them were that nothing would change. You know, your mother and father still love you. We're still in your life. And I think that and one of the reasons we stuck around is for the school year. Both yours, you were finishing grad school, and you just finished the last few weeks. Congratulations. And the kids, we didn't want to disrupt them in school. We've moved quite more often than we think we should have, so
yeah.
We didn't want to disrupt their schooling.
Yeah, they're not very happy about having to move again.
But this place has a pool, so that compensates.
I was going to say another thing was it allowed us to practice sort of being separated in that we took turns taking care of the house and the kids every other week.
Yeah, we started our custody issues.
We were all there, but just one of us had responsibility for doing the meals and getting the kids to bed and getting the kids to appointments or whatever.
Which I recommend to every couple, no matter what they're planning on doing. That was wonderful, because the way we would do it is I would be in charge for week A, and I'd be in charge of the meals and the dishes and getting the kids to school and making sure they got their homework done and getting them to bed and all that stuff. And week B, you would take that. And then if you wanted to go out, you know, to anything, then you would just plan during your week, and then you could go out, and then I would be home.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave the kids a transition, too.
Yeah, I think that worked really well.
So let's talk about the cause of divorce. We're not going to go into the specifics. Every relationship is, of course, intimate and complicated, and it really has a lot of strings. There's a lot of strings that tie any two people together. And
like a harp.
Any couple has many, many things that are working very well and are dysfunctional at any given time. That's just the nature of any human relationship.
Some strings are never there. Some strings get broken.
And even if we wanted to try to explain to you all what exactly led to our divorce, I don't think we fully understand it. And
it would probably take us about 3 days of recording.
Right. And neither of us have anywhere near that attention span. I was going to go back and listen to our divorce podcast. And we recorded that before we had started talking about divorce.
Yeah.
I think you have an unconscious idea that was bubbling around at the time.
Not for me.
At the time we recorded it, I wasn't planning or thinking about us getting a divorce. That's why I say, but you know, the idea is always there that is this the relationship that I want? Is this the person that I want to be with? Is this working? I think for a rational person, it may not be as clear as how I just said it, but those thoughts, come up.
Well, and especially if there are issues, which most marriages have, and depending on the severity of the issues and how often they come up, then those kinds of thoughts are going to creep in, you know, according to the issues and the severity.
There's two real ideas from that podcast that I want to underline, and they're not original to us. There is a cultural expectation in the West, and I can't speak to other places, that you have to squeeze every goddamn bit of goodwill out of a marriage before you walk out. That if there is any chance that the relationship can work, that you stay together.
If you can stand being around the person at all, then you might as well just stick it out.
So if you were to put a scale on a percentage of how great the relationship or how much goodwill there is or however you want to measure that, at what percentage do you get a divorce? At what percentage do you split up? 80%? 60%? I think culturally the expectation is it's down below 10%. Like, and that's why I think for so many people to get divorced, they hate each other's guts, because there's a cultural expectation that you stay until it can't be stayed anymore. You're the last person off the sinking ship.
Right. If you get along, basically, then why would you ever get divorced?
Right. And if you think about it long and hard enough, it's sort of a really screwed up idea. because what you're going to do is you're going to push things to their end. I mean, think about it in terms of employment. Like, oftentimes the job stops being satisfying, starts being stressful. But you really stick around until every single ounce of motivation is drained from you. If you do, you know, that's, you've waited too long. So that's the first idea that I think culturally, and I think there's a little sub rule that we don't train people how to divorce at all. Once you decide to divorce, and what I mean by train, you can go to counselors who know how to deal with that, and I would recommend that. But we were all raised to be married. I mean, we were all raised to fill these little roles.
We were raised to get married.
Well, even then, they trained you, but we've rejected a lot of those sex roles. But
right,
I mean,
that's
especially
what I'm saying, like, even what we were trained in, it doesn't.
But go back and get an M Men Gleaner Girl manual from 70 years ago, and they're very,
oh, yeah,
they're very clear on training sex roles.
But for us, no, it was just get married and then, you know, hopefully live happily ever after.
But they try to tell you, you know, respect, you have your man go to priesthood meeting, and you know, like, but there is a manual. It may be the wrong manual. I'm not saying it's a good one, but it's there. But when it comes time to start on a divorce path, what they'll do is they'll go put you in counseling to try to repair the marriage, right? And then you kind of get,
instead of putting you in counseling on how to divorce amicably, mm-hmm, which would be really good for people.
And there are some books out there, but it's a minor thing, and there'll be a lot of social pressure on everybody to stay together, let alone financial pressure. You know, one of the things that I'm glad, because we had the long arc, is there's so many moving parts. You're so intertwined. And for us, if we had run into a little difference, we could always just table it immediately and come back. And oftentimes when you thought about it, I feel sorry for those couples that...
It's like all of a sudden...
They're in an emotional state,
boom,
and they're getting divorced in 2 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah, and they have to sort through all of that stuff in a really heightened and volatile emotional condition.
So the first one I was talking about, there's no social conditioning. There's no real explanation of when is the right time to get divorced, you know, for the optimal life for everybody involved. And that's what I'm talking about. The second issue is we talk about failed marriages, right? But we don't talk about failed other things. You know, like when you graduate from school with a degree, they don't say you failed with your law degree, right? Because you're talking about life transitions, right?
I think a job is a better one.
Is a better example. If I tell you I worked 17 years at Smith & Barney, people say, oh, congratulations, what a great career. They don't say, and why did it fail? Why did you leave the job? For other aspects of our life, there's this idea of transition. When a child hits 18 or 19 or 20, moves out of the house, no one says, oh my God, why did your family fail? Right? Because there's an expectation that at some point that relationship, of that direct relationship of parent to child, is going to terminate, the direct relationship, and going to morph into a different type of relationship. Right?
Right. So you're saying that there should be an expectation on marriages that there could be an end to it, rather than an expectation that there will be no end to it.
Well, if I tell people that we were together 17 years, it'll be 17, our anniversary will be 17 years this summer. If I tell people we've been together 17 years and that we're divorcing, they say, oh, I'm sorry. They don't say, oh, that's incredible. That's amazing. Congratulations on 17 years. You know, it's as if we failed. We had 17 bad years because now we're separating.
Wait, you mean all of a sudden the 17 years weren't successful?
People want to throw the whole thing in a trash can. They want to binary look at a relationship. And the perverse idea is any two people that are together have a successful marriage, and any two people who've separated or divorced have had an unsuccessful relationship.
Right.
And I think it's perverse, and I think what it does is it oftentimes forces people to stay in relationships that they'd be better to be out of.
Mm-hmm.
And it forces people emotionally to go through turmoil when it comes time to terminate the relationship.
Well, yeah, because not only is it painful emotionally because you're so, I mean, even if you get to the point where you don't like the person at all, there's still a lot of emotional investment there and memories and good times and all kinds of things to sort of have to sort out emotionally.
Absolutely. And the hardest part for me, and I've heard this from other people who've gone through divorce, is you have to bury your dreams. It's not the reality of the situation that is so remorseful. It's these dreams that you had, right? That you were always going to go to Barcelona together or something that you had envisioned. When we went through counseling, you have to go through mandatory counseling when you adopt. They talked about that, and a lot of people don't realize how emotionally difficult it is to adopt. There's a mourning phase that happens for adoptive parents before they adopt because they have to mourn the loss of these children of their own that they will never have.
And it's not biological.
The biological children. They have to transition to this new phase that they are going to have adoptive children, but they will never have kids of their own. And that's an emotional difficulty. So I think one of the hard parts going through divorce is that you obviously at some point you got married, you had some sort of dreams, you had some sort of aspirations as a couple, and there is an expiration date on those. Those will not happen.
Right. And, it seems like I was going to say something else along the lines of emotional, I was going to say that not only do you have to, okay, no, this is a new thought. So rather than seeing the marriage as a failure, I kind of think of it more like, you finally filled your bucket, or you finally completed that, the end of that relationship, and not like the end, but like, what does it say in the Temple movie? To fulfill the measure of their creation. That's what happened. The relationship kind of, it was maxed out. Neither one of us could grow it anymore, as we were stifled, and not because, and we're both interesting and dynamic people, so it wasn't exactly that we were bored, but the relationship had reached the point where it wasn't giving us anything else that we needed at this time.
We both married young. And you can probably put together the trilogy of podcasts. We have the young married one, and then we have the middle divorce unconscious one, and then you're glaring at me, and then we have this one. And so we married young, and then we left the church. I want to return to leaving the church because that's why it's key for this podcast. But I am a completely different person now than I was at 23.
I'm totally and completely different than I was at 19.
And indeed, we're different people than we were 5 years ago. This period of life, I've been contemplating a lot. You know, I turned 40 this year, about midlife crises, because all my friends are going through them, and of course, and so are we. But as I'm there facing it down, I realize that the word crisis is too strong. I would rather say there's a midlife adjustment, because what happens when you hit, you know, your mid-30s, your early 40s, is you look at life and you realize and say, I'm not going to be like the star executive for this company. I've passed that point. Or you realize that there's some dreams or some aspirations you have that will never be realized, right?
Or you realize that most likely half of your life is already gone.
And that's a really downer. What I said and you said are both downers. But you also realize that there's a lot of stuff that you were working on. Like there's a lot of shit you have in the garage that you don't care about anymore. And I think oftentimes there's this re-inventory in life of saying, this is where I am, this is where I'm heading. And for those of us who've become agnostic or atheistic or have abandoned this hope of this afterlife, then your time suddenly becomes much more precious to you. And you realize that you're responsible yourself for accomplishing what you're going to accomplish. And that thought to me is sacred. You know, we make light of it by calling it a crisis, but it's because sometimes it involves toupees and 20-year-old. You know, I was walking, I was downtown yesterday, and a guy, he was obviously about 65, 68, paunchy, dressed in a polo, but like a nice polo, like a $300 polo. And he had like a 22-year-old, she was wearing a sundress, she knew how to work her hips, and they were walking hand in hand across the road, and I thought, how cliched. You know, but then I thought to myself, like, these guys are playing out. This is like I said, what do they talk about? You know, like when they go back to his, you know, mansion up in, what do they talk about?
So, maybe they have a lot in common.
Maybe they do. Maybe it's a wonderful relationship. But so there are different
maybe
types of midlife crises. She could have been an escort, but I'm glad you said that, not me, because I've been arguing with feminists lately. Okay, so
you're saying he was an escort?
Maybe he was an escort. Maybe that's her thing. I'm not judging it. I'm just pointing out they were playing by a script, you know.
And they weren't playing by. How do you know?
Because they were playing the role. I could see them. They were walking across the street. Boonka 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 boonka. I could watch them. It was straight out of a movie.
But yeah.
Okay. Please, so please. So we look at our scripts when we hit mid 30 or whatever, and we realize maybe this isn't the script that I want. Maybe there's something else that I want. And we have a lifespan that's much longer now. I'm, you know, at 40, for a large percentage, if not most of the human history, I would have been facing down the end. You know, most of my peers would have been gone.
Yeah, but our lifespan is longer, but as agnostics or atheists, it's a way shorter than it used to look.
Yes, it is. It's because where I say it becomes more precious. But I realize that I don't qualify for whatever it is, Medicaid, Medicare, whatever, retirement, until I'm 72 and a half. That's 32 and a half years. Like, I could start a whole nother career.
Well, that's another thing. Is that, you know, at 35, even though I've been married for close to 17 years, if I got married next year, I'd still be fairly young nowadays after that much more time, a whole nother lifetime of marriage.
Yeah. So that's the one thing. We all change through life. And a relationship, any couple, can go several ways. They can change in parallel, like they change together. And that's wonderful when it happens. And it's a rare gift. If you have it, rejoice. You can change in different directions. Or worse, one of you doesn't change, or both of you don't change at all. You see, some of these couples have been together a long time, and it's amazing to me how oftentimes one or both of them are milquetoast. It's like they're vacant. No one is home. And they've just sort of given up hopes and aspirations to the other person.
They're just on cruise control.
Right. So there's all these different paths, and the let's talk about leaving the church. I've been around the block long enough watching people leave the church and become, you know, New Order liberal Mormons, or leaving and becoming atheists, or becoming all sorts of things, to realize that it is a hugely dynamic journey, oftentimes in the long arc. I'm talking 5-6 years out, that changes people very drastically. And on the few times that I've been talking to couples, it's probably been 10 or 12 times where they've come to our house and one of them's a believer and one of them's not. You know, I like to have the believer acknowledge that they changed the game. That there was this expectation in that marriage, and the person who lost their faith is the one that changed the rules. And that's neither good nor bad. It just is. It's what happened. It's like getting your leg blown off in Afghanistan. It just happens. And you can't blame the person for that.
There are ramifications.
There are huge
of
ramifications.
Losing your leg.
But we so much focus on the couples where one's in and one's out, because there's one has this script that they're playing by. The script that is delivered by the church, their temple covenants and all that.
That we all know.
And the other abandon those. But what happens when they both abandon those? Because we've been meaning to do a podcast on the female ex-Mormon midlife crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But it's frankly hit too close to home, so I haven't recorded it. But I'd say
in our case it was probably the opposite.
Well, we can agree
what
to
you
disagree.
Were going to sexistly yeah. talk about women
well,
having.
Well, let me make my point, then you can shit on it. the point is that women are so there's a much more sexist drive in the church, and women are socialized much more to be a secondary role, to not get educated, to not do all this stuff. And what happens oftentimes is that women will leave the church and they realize, well, I'm still a parent, but being a mommy is not my sole reason for existing.
It's not fulfilling like they told me it would be.
It's not. And so so oftentimes I've seen this, and it's been wonderful to watch. A lot of women leave the church and then they'll go back to school, you know, in their 30s, and they'll get degrees and they'll get careers and they'll launch a second life. Well, just like we're talking about, that is a big change in personality, because there's a necessary, because oftentimes the men were already put on a career path. So they leave the church and they're like, okay, church is not true. I can drink and watch porn. But everything else stays the same, right?
Pretty much.
But for women, it's a drastic change.
It is. I thought you were going to talk about the women who all of a sudden discover their sexuality and want to
no, I don't want to
explore
go there.
That.
So it's that church drive that I think really puts them on this path. So that can change your personality, your outlook, who you interact with, who your friends are, very drastically, and put you with different wants and desires in life than what you had originally.
So are you trying to say that me...
I'm not talking about you.
Well, you said it hit close to home.
Well, that's because I'm surrounded by women all the time. No, I think it was.
I went back to school.
I had the advantage of when we left the church, I was already on my career path. And it's something that I experienced directly. And as you go through that, and I believe that I always encouraged you.
You did.
But I know that you had much more guilt. I remember one time when the kids were little and they were just shits. And they were like, and you were like, I need to get out of the house. I'm like, go get a job. That's okay. Kids turn out okay in daycare. And you were like, I realize I read the same articles that you do, but I can't.
Well, not only that, as I had a bachelor's degree that didn't help me get a job that would pay for daycare and car expenses and taxes. And you told me that, remember?
Yeah.
You said, don't get a job. That wouldn't make any financial sense.
Wait, that's not how I remember
it. Yes, you did say that.
But the point is, it's a hard negotiation because your marriage is pretexted on these roles and these definitions that were given to you in church. And you made assumptions. You went down that path, right?
I
don't want to pathologize our path at all because I don't want to look at it that way. And all this stuff, it sort of sounds like I'm taking a negative bent, but I'm not. I'm just saying that it oftentimes comes to a point where you're different and you're on different paths.
Yeah, I agree. And I know what you're saying and why, but I was going to add that I think as far as the women having their kind of rumspringa out of their role that they used to accept and into whatever they're going to become because they can kind of figure out who they are and what they want out of life. If they're married, as you were pointing to, that is a fundamental change in their person. In who they see themselves as, and then you as the husband, spouse, have to refigure out how to interact with that new person. And it's sometimes difficult because maybe before they would just go along with whatever you said because you were the man. I'm not saying that was you.
No, I agree.
And me, but I'm saying in general, and then all of a sudden they might start having their own ideas and actually expressing their opinions that are different than yours. And that's hard to deal with as someone who's always kind of been the man of the house and had someone going along with them.
Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. And I think it happens both ways, but this effect is stronger from the female side because the females were conditioned to just be accepting that way. And it can be something as simple as after leaving the church 4 or 5 years out, she comes and says, you know those camping trips we take every year? I don't like camping.
I just did that because you liked it.
Right. And she was socialized. It's not even as bad. It's more unconscious than what you're saying because she was socialized to say, you go along with he's the patriarch or whatever. And even though he might not have, this is what's the really up about the mm-hmm. whole thing. He might not have ever been asking that. He may not have ever realized that was the case. Nor did she until she got to this point and saying, who am I? What do I want? And this isn't it. And it's not his fault and it's not her fault. It's just a shitty situation.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say.
Oh, okay. So the paths diverge and leaving the church is one of those divergent paths, one that most of us who are listening are processing or thinking about. It's very similar to the divorce one, except I think that the stakes can be higher with divorce. It depends on the individual situation, but then you start getting kids involved.
You're saying leaving the church and getting a divorce are similar transitions.
They are. I think the reason I say that is if you've been through one, it will help you understand the other. And
it will feel familiar.
One time, a long time ago, I still stand by this advice. I've given it personally to people. When you have a spouse that one leaves the church and the other stays in, I advise them to read books on how to deal with a spouse who gets caught cheating. Because they're going to process it the same way. Because that losing that belief is very similar in the feelings of betrayal that they have in terms of moving away from the faith. You weren't listening to me. You were looking at beer.
No. You were saying that if you have a spouse who leaves the church, it's similar to having a spouse who you found out was cheating on you.
Right. Emotionally, I think a lot of the members process it the same way because you've taken away what they were working for, what they're living for, which is this eternal family. And that's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to divorce, you're doing a similar thing.
Does it seem to you, John, that there are a higher percentage of ex-Mormons looking at divorce than our age bracket of people in the church?
Well, I was talking to another divorced friend the other day, and we were ruminating about the fact that divorced people, once they get divorced, the odds that they'll get divorced again skyrockets. It's just through the roof. And before, I would have thought that, well, these people are failures, that they're not good at being married. Right?
Well, I think some of them probably are bad at being in relationships.
Fair enough. But I really actually think the reason that is because marriages are not good on Thursday and end on Friday. There's usually, and in my experience from talking to people, it's usually about a 3-year ramp. It's 2 or 3 years.
You start seeing signs.
You start emotionally distancing yourself, all that kind of stuff.
Realizing that things aren't lining up the way you thought they would or they did before.
So my theory is that divorced people, when that starts happening, when the roller coaster goes over the hill, they say, I'm getting the fuck out.
They jump ship.
Yeah, they're not going to go through that 3 years again. Which is a similar phenomenon to when people leave the church or really fundamentalist religions and don't go to other religions. I think it's part of that. I'm not going to be burned again. And there's a strong anarchist, anti-authoritarian streak that runs through like ex-Mormons. And I think that's part of it. They're like, I was burned by authoritarian structures. I just don't want to deal with them anymore. And I think it's the same sort of element.
Well, and you saying that made me think that people who leave the church, not just the women, like we said before, but everybody is kind of re-examining who they are and what their life means. And that includes what is this relationship I'm in and what is it giving to me? Because I don't have to put up with things just because I made an oath in a temple. I don't have to go along with what I previously promised.
Right. And once again, I don't want to give the impression that either one of us were trying to like steer the other one in directions, but as you realize that compromise and some of the little compromises may not be as productive. Like if you're in a temple marriage again, you know, you're in it for the long haul, so you're compromising everything. I found one of the things that keeps Mormons together, and Mormons when they're married to ex-Mormons, is they've got an eternity to sort out all their issues.
They don't have to work it all out
here. If it's screwed up now, then that's fine. We can work it out 10,000 years from now on Kolob, you know.
When we're more perfected.
And once again, to go back to our thing, we don't have that luxury. And when there is some exploration of self, I'm 40 years old. I have a master's degree. I have a great job. This is the first time coming out of that I ever lived alone. Meaning the Mormon paradigm was to hand me off from mother to mother to mother. So, you know,
For us, father to father to father.
Right, right. It's a double-edged thing, and it's a bind. And they want you in that. They don't want to give you any time to think. They don't want to give you any time to be alone. They don't want to give you any time to discover who you are individually and what it is that you're trying to get out of life.
Well, but you saying that, I just want to express something that I think there is too much of an emphasis on, like, who am I as an individual? Because I don't think that it's really possible to figure that out entirely, because you're always interacting with other people and you need other people. And to think that you would feel completely fine and okay being alone every day, it's just not going to happen, because we're not, unless you're, you know, special emotionally, it's, you need other people. Well, so, like, I don't know exactly how you would find out who you are as an individual, because I don't really think that's possible.
I agree, because you're right. I was framing it as if it's a destination, but we evolved to be problem solvers. And the problem with being a problem solver in this world is we live in paradise. So all the problems have pretty much been solved.
You mean in America, for most of us, we don't have a lot of...
Right. We don't have the kind of problems our ancestors faced, right? We're not getting chased down by cheetahs or anything like that. And we live comparatively like kings, you know, from only 400 or 500 years ago. So that's what I mean. But because we like problems, we create problems. Or we have the luxury of having even this discussion where for most people in marriages, they were worried about putting food on the table, and to break the family union would have been, you could starve to death.
It didn't have anything to do with individual satisfaction at all.
So I'm agreeing with you, but I do think that there's a journey.
No, and I know what you mean as far as kind of figuring out how to take care of yourself, how to do all of the things that before, maybe with you and I, you would do some things always, and I would do some things always, and so neither one of us got to learn those other parts of taking care of ourselves, if you know what I mean. So more than trying to find out who you are as a person is like figuring out what it takes to be an adult, a fully responsible for everything.
Yeah, and I think there's an element of interdependence that we have that's healthy. If it's on a spectrum, if you veer too far and you're too isolated and too solo, well, it's just like anything. When you're at work or whatever, you need to bounce ideas off other people, because if you think about something too long, it starts getting warped in your head. So there's this being an element of being too alone and not being, and there's an element of being so interdependent that your relationship becomes unhealthy.
And John and I kind of tended toward that
on direction. Some, and I think once again, there were lots of connections, and some of them were really healthy and some of them might not have been so healthy.
Yeah. Some of them were like tied, like super wound around each other so tight that it was hard to see even what was there anymore.
And you see this play out with couples, in that couples will speak to each other kind of like they speak to dogs or to children, because they're so – they do not – and this is the point I'm trying to make. That it's easy in a long-term relationship to stop seeing the person as an other. There is this us and them, you know, mentality that bleeds through everything in life. The problem is it is a balance, especially in a relationship, because if you go too far and we become too much of an us, we become too much of a unit, then you can be, cause your inner voice, let's be frank, is very critical. Your inner voice to yourself is very critical. It's all the time telling you what you shouldn't be doing. And you can start bleeding that over into your spouse. And I still find, like you were at the house today, that I can be more abrupt with you then I'll be with anybody, and you do the same thing back to me. That you don't treat your spouse as well as you treat strangers or friends, and it's because you start blurring that distinction between you and them.
Well, yeah, it becomes so familiar that, like you said, you stop seeing them as a person, as an actual human being.
Right. Yeah. And because we were all pushed into marriages so young with no experience with relationships, I mean, we don't have to talk about no sexual experience, just no experience dealing with the opposite sex, dealing with other people. And I think what's more normal is that you go through and you kind of learn who you are. You learn who you are by interacting with people and by exploring boundaries. Mm-hmm. And normally you go to college or whatever and you explore boundaries. You say, I don't like going to Kegers. I like skiing. I like going backpacking. You know, we all got married so young that we even didn't have capital to just do the normal things that people do because we were having babies. And so we didn't even get to explore those elements of ourselves. And I think that sometimes leads, not everybody, I think it's people who do it healthily, but this strong interdependence. So, you know, one of the challenges that we both have, and I'm sure all couples do, is that transition from being a couple, being John and Zilpha, to being John and Zilpha. And that is a and hard thing to do. And that's why most couples or a lot that go through divorce end up hating each other, because they just have to get the distance. They just, they can't interact because you have to reset all those interaction points.
Well, because you've been so intertwined and you have so much emotional investment, it's not easy to turn off the emotions. You can't, basically. So either you have to find a new way of interacting positively, or it's going to come out in venom and even hate.
Well, and
because there are so many emotions, and especially to know that, you know, your spouse is going to be dating other people and seeing other people in a special way that you always were.
Make.
Yeah. That it does bring up emotions that are hard to deal with.
Right. And often it's surface things that I'm sure that where you're being controlling, where you're being domineering, where you're being unfair, and you're confronting. I think this is one of the reasons it's easier to hate your ex, because if you try to do it amicably, you're having to constantly face down your own inner demons, because you have to ask yourself all the time, why does that upset me?
Why is that triggering this response?
Right. And then you realize, oh my God, I'm being so unfair. And that happens over and over again. I'm being so possessive, you know, that, oh, she went to dinner with some guy. That's mine. That's mine. Only I can do that.
Right.
And that's really an unhealthy, in my mind, an idealized relationship is one where you're choosing. You're together because it's a choice. And it's not because you have to be with that person or you're not allowed to be with anybody else. It's that you're taking care of each other emotionally. And oftentimes when you get off track, then you start doing the trappings of that without having the heart behind it. And that leads to friction. But, you know, for me, one of the models that I've learned, and you know, we were married close to 17 years. I've spent more time with you than anybody else. And the model that I've tried to move myself to is to treat you like my sister. And it sounds weird and incestuous, but bear with me for a second. Because your siblings are your siblings. You grow up together. You have that shared experience. And they can do dumb things, but you never think. Most normal people never say, you are no longer my sister. You know, you have that relationship. And oftentimes with your sister, you're close enough to call them out on their bullshit more than you would your friend sometimes. Because you know your sister can't stop being your sister. You might not speak for 6 months, but as a spouse, you feel like full dominion. I mean, and I'm talking about from both sides, to call them out on anything at any time. Are you going to wear those pants with those shoes, you know, that you have this full, total domain, and then you have to sort of split that off and get a new one. But I think it's hard to pretend that you're strangers. It's hard to pretend that
you can't pretend that you're strangers. And it is sort of like having a sibling, but even more intimate and more emotions involved. But the idea that once you've lived with somebody for so many years and you've shared so much with them, they are your family, and they will always be something more significant than anybody else. And that's not something that you can just, you know.
Agreed.
That it won't disappear, and it shouldn't disappear, because you took care of each other, you know, helped each other through hard times, helped each other take care of children, take care of houses, all those kinds of things that contribute to this vast bucket full of memories and emotions that are good to help you move to a more healthy place as far as not hating the person and not seeing them as a monster or a demon. Because I've heard so many people talk about their exes in such a vicious way that it just doesn't make any sense how, if they know that person more than anybody else, but it's like they're forgetting who that person actually is. They have such a warped view by the time they get done with the divorce that it's unhealthy.
Yeah.
Especially for if you have children and you're trying to sort that out and the children are seeing that.
Well, fundamentally, that you are a product. If you've been in a relationship for a long time, whether you like it or not, you are a product of that relationship. And I think one of the reasons people can do that is can turn against their spouse. Let's say you're buying a house together. Odds are you're going to pick a house that is a compromise between both of your wants, meaning that house might not have been at the top of either one of your lists. So you can go back and look at this narrative life saying, there's all these things. I wanted to go to graduate school, but instead we had a baby. And I wanted to paint the house yellow. Instead we painted it
taupe. I wanted to listen to music at night. And right. She didn't want to.
Right. So then you can go back and you can pathologize all those compromises.
But you were both compromising all the time.
As you would in any good relationship. So you really need to look back and say that person. That's why the courts look at it. That's why alimony is structured the way it is. Because the idea is that the person contributed to who you are. And I think it's almost a pattern of self-loathing to really turn on your spouse a lot. Now, granted, there's a lot of abuse and negativity out there, and we're really not dealing with those issues here in this podcast. For the record, Zilpha never abused me.
John poked me once.
I did poke
with his finger.
With my finger. You deserved it.
Oh, he poked me, with other things, but we're not going to go there.
So yeah, you do have to reset everything and don't get me wrong, that is really really fucking hard to do.
Wait, what is? I was thinking about
the resetting yourself, resetting the relationship, resetting your own expectations for that other person, learning to see them as another person and no longer your husband or your wife.
Yeah. Giving them the benefit of the doubt, which is hard to do when you're in this emotional soup of turmoil and chaos that divorce usually is.
And allowing them to make mistakes.
Like you do. Not you, but allowing the other person to make mistakes and acknowledging that you make mistakes as well.
Right. And realizing that for people who've been in long-term relationships, when they go hit the dating scene or even just socializing, they're all... I was going to say retarded, but then the editor will edit it out. They've been writing out my R words. You are socially inept. I mean, is the best way to look at it.
Well, yeah, especially like you and I, where we were married so young and we never had sexual experiences outside of each other. And then you're all of a sudden supposed to like figure out new relationships and all of that. And really, you have no idea what you're doing. And neither does anybody else.
Right. So, us today. I've moved. We just sold the house. Our intent...
Well, it's under contract.
It's under contract.
I don't count my chickens before they hatch.
Our plan is for you to move near... We picked the area where we're going to live, where I live now.
Draper.
In South Valley and Draper. As a compromise. I mean, still, even though we're, and I think this is a mark of still good, being a good divorce, because I think you sort of made this point before, and I want to circle back and emphasize it, that you have a relationship. We will always be the parents of our children, and we always be co-parents, and ideally we keep interacting in a very healthy way. And I realize that some of that is outside people's control. There are people who were married to real assholes, and that makes it really hard.
Or they turn into an asshole because of the emotional turmoil of the divorce.
Yes.
And they can't handle interacting with that person anymore.
So we fully acknowledge that we are still connected together and that we had our 17 years together and that will never go away, nor do we want it to go away. Nor do we even have to define, you know, like people talk about true love or my soul companion or whatever. Well, hell, maybe we were, but that doesn't mean we are now. Or maybe we still are, but we need something else. Or... or there's just some other path, some other door we need to go through. But that state of today doesn't reflect anything on the state of yesterday. And I know my mom reminded me of this. I have three great uncles, three of my father's uncles, that all divorced and then remarried. And I have one that divorced the same woman twice.
They all divorced and remarried the same person?
Yes. Oftentimes they married other people, but they ended up. And I'm not saying I don't expect that will happen to us. I don't plan on that happening to us. But you never know. Myself from 10 years ago would have never predicted this. And I don't even bother trying to predict where I'm going to be in 10 years. It's not even useful.
Right. But hopefully in about 3 or 4 weeks, I'll be moving up closer to you.
But in a sense, we will always be family.
Not in a sense. I mean, just as much as, like, our children are adopted, but we've lived with them less time than we've lived with each other. It's sort of like we are family. We are.
Right. So that's where we are. So what about the podcast? Are you going to keep coming on the podcast?
Yeah, if you invite me. I'm going to plan one.
Okay.
But
I think that Zilpha will continue to be on the podcast. I obviously sort of run the podcast. Zilpha will continue to be. But the reality of the situation is, and sometimes out of emotional necessity, we don't interact as much as we did before.
Well, and plus we have our weeks, week on, week off,
right.
week on, week off. But we're not supposed to be with each other all the time anymore.
Right.
That's why we're divorcing.
And right now, neither one of us are in relationships. We're both dating, but neither one of us have a full-time relationship. And when that sort of thing happens, which inevitably it will, that will once again impact our relationship. It's inevitable. And that there's probably a closeness that we have now that will drift.
But that could come back closer, and hopefully we could get along with whoever the other person happens to choose. That would be nice.
Hopefully, but I mean, you're free to choose whoever you want without my input.
That would just make it a lot harder, right?
Right. But
and a lot of people have to deal with that.
Everyone will have to deal with it eventually. Just like Katie's eventually going to marry some douchebag, right?
Not necessarily. It's not inevitable. It's inevitable that we can't control it.
Right. That's my point. It won't be her daddy, though.
What?
No, I wasn't trying to be gross or anything like that.
I hope not.
But as a father,
you mean it won't. You're saying that no husband could ever be as good.
No,
as...
No, I'm not like that. But you have that concern, you know, for like, and I think it's played out as we've talked when we've been dating.
You were like, you think that guy's better than me? That's who you're going to replace me with?
Things. You've said the same thing.
For real.
You do measure yourself by who. Oh, that's the league I was playing in? You do measure yourself a little bit by who the other person picks. And I'm to a point, frankly, where I've gotten beyond a lot of the jealousy. I'm happy for you, but it takes a lot of time. And, you know, that represents sort of even years of emotionally transitioning for us. And I think it'll continue to happen, you know.
But the point is that you're trying to make is that it takes time to get over some of the emotional, intensity.
It does. And some of it will never completely go away. And that's a good thing. Just like I tell people who are leaving the church, you'll come to a point of acceptance. You'll come to a point where you no longer fully, you want to be a non-Mormon. That's what you want. You want it to all go away. You wish it wasn't there. But there'll come to a point where you need to accept that's...
It's a part of you.
That's a part of you.
And it helped form who you are.
And you can't eliminate it. And you just need to acknowledge it and realize it, just like the marriage and the relationship and the relationships after. All right. Did we satisfy everybody's curiosity? Zilpha... good luck on your journey.
Thanks, John. I'm sure we'll be fine.
Yeah, we're doing. I can tell you. You know, we probably hit the darkest period around about December,
January,
and we're both doing tons better. We're both in a much healthier place. You know, and I would recommend this to other people. I'm starting counseling. You've only got a short life to live. You know, you just as well play the best hand. You know, you can play. And I think that realization of what I am and what I can do and what I have, and realistically take that on, is you're going to be much better in life.
Hopefully.
All right.
We'll see.
Well, as always, the discussion will continue on the website at MormonExpression.com. You're still looking at me funny.
I know, you just said that a little differently than normal.
Oh, sorry. You can go to the VIP Lounge on Facebook, search Mormon Expression VIP Lounge, and you can find that.
Lots of people on there, lots of friends.
And you're free to drop Zilpha or I a line. So if you want to talk to Zilpha...
just send me a message on Facebook.
What if they're not on Facebook? What if I get in Indonesia or something?
Oh, then do the Mormon Expression, Zilpha at MormonExpression.com.
Or you can contact me on Facebook, or you can email me at John at MormonExpression.com. All right, Zilpha.
Thanks, John.
Love you.
Love you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And I don't know, is this the part where you let go and tumble? The field, are you holding on? Are you holding on to the last sweet light? When the flame leaves your eyes, I still see you there. I still see your darkest night. And I don't know, is this the part where you let go and sinking under a shadow? Is this the part where you find out I'm there for you now? Your hand.